Hello, I'm Michael McKenzie. Welcome to RN First Bite, where today we talk about food before it enters the mouth and after it leaves the kitchen. Before we eat, we season. And when we season, we often use this stuff.
Because when you say you want to add a pinch of salt, that's what you want to do. You want to add a pinch.
A pinch.
So feeling it between your fingers is actually quite satisfying. And some of the most famous chefs around the world, like Thomas Keller, uses exclusively kosher salt in all of his cookbooks and all of his cooking for that very reason.
But isn't sodium chloride just sodium chloride? Separating the salt from the chaff a little later. But the life of my first guest changed dramatically when he read a UN report on how much food we waste globally. He was so shocked by what he read, he dropped what he was doing and rushed down to the local supermarket to buy food. Then he took that food back to his flat in Vienna, where he made a point not to eat it. Instead, Klaus Pickler photographed it as it rotted in his place for weeks. The resulting images have now been seen by the UN, and I spoke to Klaus by Skype about the process. And a warning, if you're eating right now, best put it aside for this story.
I thought it's easy to take photos of rotting food, but it's not easy to coexist with rotting food. And to make myself credible, I tried to go the hard way. I turned my toilet into some kind of rotting station. I had an amount of plastic containers where I stored the food and left it to rot. And when it was ready, I took it to my living room and photographed it in the studio.
You've labelled the resulting collection of photographs one third.
Because one third is the amount of food that gets thrown away worldwide. This UN survey was the first global survey on this issue. And they found out that in industrialized countries, this one-third of food gets thrown away mainly due to consumers' decision and supermarket policy. And also in not so much developed or industrialized countries, this one-third of food gets thrown away because of transportation issues and storage issues and distribution. So this was really shocking that this report was the first global report on it, and it's all around the world that one-third of food gets thrown away.
So let's talk about the photographs now, because they are both repugnant and beautiful all at the same time. You really did suffer, literally, for your art. For how long in your own apartment?
All in all, the project was at a duration of 9 months, and the smells were variable. It depended if I had some meat in production or some dairy products, or if it just were vegetables or fruits. Sometimes it was really hard. For example, imagine the chicken rotting 3 weeks in your own flat. That was really, really horrible. And I had it in the rotting station together with the octopus, and these smells of these two rotting items, they blended in a really, really horrible way. So that was hard to stand. But I thought it was necessary for me to do it. And of course, I cooperated with the local university, with the microbiologists. And whenever I had some new mold appearing, then I made a picture and sent them, and they told me if it was poisonous or not. So I took great care, and I also made the photos with protection, with masks and eyeglasses, not to have any health hazards.
Because of the fungal spores that were growing molds on your food that could actually get into your lungs. What about insects? What about flies? What about maggots?
There were plenty of, but the maggots were in the containers. That was not the problem, and I had no problem with the flies. And I refurbished my flat after I was finished with the project. And while I was doing it, I was really, really tidy. I was cleaning up every 2 or 3 days, much more than usual, and made a total cleanage of the flat, because I felt it was necessary to make some kind of statement for myself that it's still a flat to live in.
But Klaus is determined that the abstract stylings of his rotting food photographs is grounded still in reality. So he consulted not only food producers, but also environmental research organisations to present stark reminders of how these tasty treats arrived at his Viennese apartment in the first place. For example, under the almost floral display of rotting bananas. You have got place of production, bearing in mind you're living in Austria, Mao Valverde in the Dominican Republic, transport distance to you 8,500 kilometres, that's linear distance. Then you've got the mode of transport by shipping and truck, cultivation, outdoor plantation, harvest time, all season. The carbon footprint for these rotting bananas per kilogram, 1,061 kilograms. Water requirement, 643 kilograms. And price is €1.49 per kilogram.
In my opinion, if we buy food, it's a highly political decision. At first, I tried to find out the basic data from the cardboards in which the food was transported.
So that's the ingredients list on the back of the packaging?
Yes. In some points, it was very easy to find out something, but in some points, it was really, really hard because, the producers and the distributors, they are not interested in providing the data to anybody, and they are not forced to. So in some cases, it was really, really hard to find out.
What's food miles got to do with food wastage?
I tried to link two discourses with each other because my project started from a quite naive point. I imagined an orange from, let's say, Spain or South Africa, which is brought up with big effort and then harvested and transported over long distances just to get thrown away in the country where it is sold. So this was quite depressing for me, this idea, and quite naive. And this was the starting point, because I thought if I concentrate on food waste, I also have to concentrate on the mode of production and of this global food issue.
So when I say that these images are both beautiful and repugnant, what do I mean? I mean there's a shot of brown, glistening tendrils of rot at the base of an aging fennel, giving it the appearance of a headless chicken, being held rather coyly in the arms of a black porcelain lady sporting a rakish sombrero. There's the blackened flesh of a watermelon that's being squeezed into a light-filled glass goblet. And the effect of these photographs is so startling that I wondered if Klaus was blunting his message of waste by making these images so entrancing.
Wrapped with wire, tapped to the heart.
No, because in my intention it was a provocation, and the aesthetics of the project were borrowed from advertising photography, and in particular from luxury photography. Items like rings or jewelry or even cars and diamonds and watches in front of a black background to declare our rotting food as a luxury thing. For me, globalized food is luxury, it's nothing else.
One man's righteousness is another man's love.
What was the food that surprised you most when it decomposed?
I think it was not the food, but the mold that appeared. For example, the noodles that were just normal noodles. And I remember when I went away on Friday and the noodles just had white spots. And when I came back, they were disappeared because there was mold all over it, like 3 or 4 centimeters high. And it was a white mold like fur. So that was really surprising me.
And did you find that when you did photograph processed food, that it rotted in different ways to raw food or unprocessed food?
Yes, of course. Because there are lots of conservation stuff. I don't know what it's called in English.
Preservatives? Preservatives?
Yeah, preservatives in it, sorry. For example, the deep frozen cake, there was 4 weeks of nothing, really. It looked the same. And then immediately it started to get rancid, and then it changed, but 4 weeks it was nothing. It reacted like this cliche McDonald's cheeseburger. Just 4 weeks of doing nothing.
Now, Klaus, tell us what happened when you took the resulting collection of these stunning-looking photographs of food decomposing to Rome to actually exhibit in front of parts of the United Nations.
It was interesting because there were lots of positive reactions. And I think it was in front of the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, and I think all of the members of this organization are dealing with food waste and globalized food transportation issue all the time. So it was interesting because they sensed it was like a visualization of their surveys and of their studies. And these people, they really got the connection in the first moment. It was really interesting for me.
Klaus, it's been an absolute pleasure, and congratulations on coming up with such a thought-provoking way of displaying just how profligate we are with food when it comes to waste. And thank you so much for joining us on RN First Bite.
Thanks a lot.
Professional photographer Klaus Pickler. And right now, his exhibition, One Third, is in Nairobi, and there's other stops to follow in Moscow, Vienna, and California. However, you can see some of these photographs right now because I've posted some choice examples on the RN First Bite website. Plus, there's a link to Klaus's own website for more information. So next time I chuck out something grisly from the fruit bowl or vegetable crisper, I'll pause and perhaps think about how it could have been used after how far it's come. You're with RN First Bite, on air, online through Radio National, and contactable through Facebook and Twitter.
I'm Marie-Morgane Moël, and I'm the writer of Secrets of a Lazy French Cook. The best thing about French food is that it actually tells a story. Some people might think that French food is actually pretentious or it has to be complicated. But actually, it's been transmitted from generations to generations of people, of families. And many of the recipes are actually were ways to use the leftovers. So it was really country food and not pretentious at all. So I came here from Paris 5 years ago now. It was for my job. I'm a correspondent for a French newspaper, Le Monde, and also the correspondent for a French international radio. So the thing I miss most about French food is the cheese and the bread, but especially cheese. I come from Franche-Comté, which is a region in eastern France, very well known for its cheese, and of course the Comté, which comes from the name of the region. And I really like to be able to go to the cheese producers, and so you talk to them about the way they did the cheese, they made the cheese, and it's very convivial. Australian food. Australian food is surprising, I guess. I didn't expect it to be so diverse. I guess when I came here, I thought it would be more British, and I would have meat pies and meat pies. And actually, I realized that there was lots of immigration here, and you had all these Italians and Greeks, and probably the best coffee I've ever tasted anywhere. And so I was really impressed, actually. And I guess something which is impressive when you come here is to have all these fruits and these tropical fruits available, and like mango. And for me, having mangoes which come from the country you live in, still after 5 years, that's amazing. My ultimate food moment was very simple. It was on an island in Brittany, and on a very small island where you can only get by boat, and there was no electricity in the restaurant. You got there barefoot, and it was just grilled sardines. But the view was fantastic, so it was the best one. My last supper menu would be fish terrine as a starter, with fresh bread, which would still be warm from the baker. Then I would have a veal marengo. Then I would have cheese with Comté and Munster, very smelly cheese, and then I would have probably some chocolate mousse, because if it's my last dinner, I don't really mind about the calories anymore. And of course, I would have a very good Burgundy red wine, like Chassagne Montrachet. Food to me is an experience. It's also something which needs to be comforting and reassuring. To me, being a lazy cook means that you don't sweat what you do in the kitchen. And for instance, the other day I tried to do a veal marengo, but I realized afterwards that I didn't have veal anymore. So I just looked at what I had in the fridge and it was chicken. So I did a chicken marengo. It was actually one of my best recipes. So yes, that's what it means to be a lazy cook.
And Marie's book, Secrets of a Lazy French Cook, a memoir of a French woman grappling with culture shock, is peppered with sweat-free recipes. And while you're online, check out our new blog, Back of House. This week, our guest blogger is one of our very own. Justine Sloan-Lees produces Poetica, but that's really only in her spare time. Her real mission, after 20 years hard training, tweaking and finessing, is to take out the Grand Prix of preserves, best in class, at next weekend's Foster Show in Victoria. Justine's blog takes us deep inside the world of competitive preserving, and we wish her luck. Based on what we've tasted, she's definitely in with a chance. Her recipe for her award-winning fig and vanilla jam is online now.
I have it. This is actually, you are basically going to be the test case right now.
Oh, good.
For the class that is going to be running.
Yes.
I've done a bit of taste testing myself.
Alice Bell works for Gewürzhaus, German for Spice House, and Alice has been uncovering the incredible history, myths, legends and techniques surrounding one of our most ancient of seasonings and condiments, salt.
Salt has been incredibly important. You look at all these different cultures around the world and salt became sort of a de facto monetary product in many different societies. I was joking with one of my colleagues before that in ancient Roman times, the salary, the word salary is actually attached to the word salt, and the Roman soldiers would receive a monetary salary, but they'd also receive an allocation of salt as part of their benefit, which, somewhat ironically or not, is actually how our salaries are organised here at Gewürzhaus. We do get an allowance to be able to enjoy some of the salts and the spices and the different products as part of our salary packaging. I don't think you could find many people in Australia who could say that.
What's driving this is Alice is in the midst of constructing a public taste test, but I have to say, I'm a little sceptical. When I did chemistry at a very basic level and physics and science at school, sodium chloride is salt, and so salt should just be salt is just salt. So how can you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 different types of salt?
Most of these salts you'll see before you are a common salt, our sodium chloride, but we've actually got salts such as the Persian blue salt, which is a potassium chloride. So it's still, like, we would still call it a salt, but people that are on low sodium diets will often use it as a salt substitute. And what's interesting about the Persian blue salt or potassium chloride salts is that while you taste them and you go, that's a saltiness, I can definitely taste that is salt, at the same time there's something a bit unfamiliar and a bit different about it. The same way if you taste sugar and an artificial sweetener, you would say that the artificial sweetener is definitely sweet, but there's something a little bit different about it. And you can actually pick that up on the salt.
Wow, it's that marked. Because that's a great analogy, if that's true.
It is a great analogy. And yeah, it is quite pronounced. It's like there's something that I can't quite recognise that's distinct about this. So say with the black lava salt that's from Cyprus, there's an ash with it that actually gives it a bit of a flavour.
Volcanic ash.
The volcanic ash, that's correct.
So Persian blue salt, can we get
Persian
that one out first?
Yeah.
There's that. And then you mentioned the black lava.
The black lava. And the other is the Hawaiian sea salt.
Right. Okay. So Persian blue, I take it, is from Iran?
Yes, this is from Iran. It is harvested from inland salt mines. And what gives it its name, as you'll see when I pour out a little bit of a sample, is the fact that there are actually blue crystals in the salt, or crystals that look with the appearance of blue.
So if I was a salt sommelier And I believe
Sel Millier.
Sel Millier.
So the Sel for salts, replacing the traditional wine sommelier title, yes.
So I'm a Sel Millier.
Yep.
When would I be recommending the Iranian, the Persian Blue?
A lot of these salts I would recommend as finishing salts, by which we mean we want to add them to the end of food. So even thinking about what is the colour of the food that I would be serving with this Persian blue salt, you know, a seafood dish perhaps, and then try and invoke the ocean waters with the blue colours.
Blue grenadier.
Blue grenadier. Fantastic. Friday night fish and chips.
Yes. I gingerly sprinkle a few of these Persian blue salt crystals onto a piece of freshly sliced cucumber and raise it to my mouth. Okay, well, lay me down with a feather. It tastes like salt.
It tastes like salt.
Yeah, I'm not... Yep, that's what I'm getting. It's salt. Okay, now while that's still in my mouth and I'm tasting that, can I use the same bit of cucumber and can you put something from, say, the black lava or...
Certainly can.
...on there?
Certainly can.
I want to feel and taste
feel,
that contrast that you're talking about.
Yeah. No, so I suppose, again, it's a little bit like tasting wine. The first time if you were to taste wine and someone was to say to you, what are the characteristics that you're picking up on there? And
like, yeah.
It's wine. It's definitely red.
All right. Well, you've yet to convince me. You talk a good game here, Alice. Here we go.
So you can see with these crystals of the black lava salt.
Oh, look at that. Completely different.
They're quite light. They're obviously, there's a flakiness to them.
They look like pieces of ash.
The charcoal that is in the salt is actually, it looks not too dissimilar to what you would find if you had flaked some charcoal. But so you'll get a slight smokiness with the flavour, but then also because it's quite light, you're actually going to get a stronger burst of salt. And because the crystals are quite large compared, you'll get an immediate hit on the tongue that's going to be quite intense, but it's going to dissolve quite quickly. So it may not carry quite as long as the Persian Blue.
Let me have a go.
Let you have a try.
This is a black lava salt from Cyprus. I've put a couple. Should I put more shards on?
You can put as many as you like.
I say shards because compared to the tiny crystals of Iran, the Persian Blue, these are like giant bloody boulders, aren't they? Look at
these. They're quite large, and some of the other crystals that I can show you are even larger.
I have to say, that is a different experience.
It is.
I'm not sure whether my eyes are fooling me into thinking it's a different experience. The giant crystals of the black lava, obviously I'm aware of that as I go in, but I'm finding the release of salt is not as dramatic up front as the Persian Blue, and there's a longer-lasting taste with the cucumber at the back of the mouthful.
Yeah.
So you've told your story very well, Alice.
Well, I'd be lying if I didn't recognise... I used to study psychology. I'd be lying if I didn't recognise that, you know, when tasting foods, that things like colour and environment and obviously narrative are pretty important to that. But then that's how we have food. You know, we don't normally eat food in a blind taste test with no context.
Nor do we want to. And as you say, I mean, food is bound up with people gathering and telling stories and being part of a moment together that will hopefully carry on in people's memory. So doing what you're doing as we talk is completely appropriate. And I can taste that is different now to the inland salt of Iran.
Yeah, and another thing that a lot of people like about...
Alice continues to weave her magic, introducing me to the delicate bunched crystals of the French fleur de sel, harvested from the shores of Brittany. And as I crunch through the history of the world, Alice tells me her research took her back 4,500 years to ancient China and the Peng Zhao Kan Mu, one of the first documents devoted to pharmacology, which also discusses the attributes of 40 different kinds of salt. Since then, the crystals have been extracted from the earth or evaporated out of the sea, all over the globe. Exchanging salt for slaves in ancient Greece gave rise to the expression, not worthy salt. The Austrian city of Salzburg now proudly opens its ancient salt mines to tourists. The French aristocracy taxed salt so severely in the 17th and 18th centuries, it was one of the triggers for the revolution. It's been used to flavour food, preserve it for long voyages, and even treat wounds as an antiseptic. In the sub-Sahara, in the 6th century, salt was traded for gold, ounce for ounce.
My favourite salt to cook with is actually the kosher salt. The way that they make the kosher salt is so that it has these particular irregularities in the crystals, so that when you're using it to kosher food, it sticks to the meat and absorbs the blood out of the meat well. But a lot of people prefer it for cooking, because when you say you want to add a pinch of salt, that's what you want to do. You want to add a pinch.
A pinch.
So feeling it between your fingers is actually quite satisfying. And some of the most famous chefs around the world, like Thomas Keller in the US, uses exclusively kosher salt in all of his cookbooks and all of his cooking for that very reason. And that's also another really attractive quality for our customers, that when they're getting their salt, they're getting something more than just their sodium chloride.
Alice Bell, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for coming round.
And Alice's work on salt history and single origin salt all comes together in the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival, when the Gewürzhaus Spice Kitchen Cooking School holds a masterclass in tasting and cooking as well, using a slab of Himalayan rock salt as a base. We'll put details on our website, along with links to health reports on safe levels of salt within our diet, and how most breads in Australia now contain the essential trace element iodine in response to falling usage of iodised salt in our cooking. Next week on RN First Bite, what do you listen to when you're drinking a cheeky Chardonnay on a Sunday afternoon? Well, according to one of our guests, this will help you enjoy the experience just a little more. And if you're chowing down on seafood, add a little of this to really get those taste buds tingling. Reckon that works for you? Well, join us next week when we delve into the interplay of music, food, wine, and the brain. Off Track with Joel Werner is up next, in which he retraces the steps of Ludwig Leichhardt's exploration of Mount Royal. It's about an hour north of Singleton in New South Wales. Maria Tickle produces RN First Bite. Melissa May is on the technicals. I'm Michael McKenzie, and we'll catch up next week. In the meantime, if you feel like it, why don't you drop us some feedback online? Bye for now.
Australia is losing species at quite a clip. So many animals and plants are on the endangered list that they cannot all be saved. In fact, most of them can't be saved. So which ones should we try to keep? And how do we go about deciding that? Those two questions are at the heart of the work of Hugh Possingham, ecologist, mathematician, world-class scientist and environmental advocate. And you can hear him on Sunday Profile. Download or stream at abc.net.au/radionational.